we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Happy Friday, November 23rd, 2018, and welcome to Animal Voices, Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. We're broadcasting from CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. I'm your host today, Carol Davies McIntosh, and I'm here with co-host Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our sound resistance operator, Jody. Thank you, Jody. This show is brought to you by our sponsor, Edible Planet. Edible Planet is a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people that bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth, end chronic illness, and regreen the planet, and create world peace today. Now's the time for a plant-based economy, because on this big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. Our feature interview today is with Dr. Elizabeth Ormandy of Animals and Science Policy Institute, affectionately called ASPE. Elizabeth will join us just before 12:30 to talk about ASPE and their work, including how she has been working with schools in Greater Vancouver to provide non-animal solutions to studying animal anatomy. Before we get to that, Sinead and I were fortunate enough to attend the ASPE fundraiser and annual public lecture at the Kulch last week. We're happy to get a mini interview with Dr. Jonathan Balcombe from What a Fish Knows, which we'll play for you in just a few minutes. First, just a little info about Jonathan. Jonathan's a biologist with a PhD in ethology, which is the study of animal behavior, including human behavior, by the way. He's the author of four popular science books on the inner lives of animal, including What a Fish Knows. His focus is always on animal behavior and animal protection. Formerly Department Chair for Animal Studies in the Humane Society University and Director of Animal Sentience with the Humane Society of the United States in Washington, D.C. He's now returned to Canada and lives in Ontario, and we're happy to have him back. We need him here.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it was a great lecture on Friday at the Kulch over there. It his talk, I think so many people need to learn about this stuff because fish are everywhere in our lives. We rely on them for our survival. Their role in the ecosystem is so important, and the ways that humans interact with fishes on a day-to-day basis is really just a lot of people don't understand what it is or who it is that they're dealing with.
Exactly. I like the way that he talked about animals and promoting compassionate living in a kind of a quiet way by teaching us about the behaviors of fishes so we can see them as individuals, like much like we do cows or horses or dogs. In fact, that's one of the things that really stood out to me is he uses the term fishes rather than the usual fish to indicate more than one fish. He says that clearly pluralizing the word highlights that we're talking about individuals rather than an anonymous group having no outstanding individual or it features. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, we say human, humans, cow, cows. Why not fish, fishes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, both terms, I think, are technically correct, but you're right, you know, it's sort of like when people talk about eating chickens, you know, people say, I eat chicken or I don't eat chicken, but whether you eat chicken flesh or not, what what you're eating is chickens, like individuals
right.
that used to be alive and then they're not anymore. And that's the same with fish. These are individuals we're dealing with, which, you know, they have memories. There's that myth about the 3-second memory of a goldfish, and that's what people use to justify keeping them in barren little bowls their whole lives. But no, fish have memories. They can recognize human faces. That was one of the things that actually struck me in the talk, is he talks about how there are fishes who actually recognize human faces that I was looking at those pictures and I'd have trouble recognizing one from the other, especially for a particular length of time, and especially through water. You know,
exactly.
They're incredible. They certainly have minds of their own.
They do. And he showed a picture also of a woman. I guess she had an aquarium, and the fish was coming up to the glass. A picture of the fish while it was interacting with her, and you could see there was like eye contact. It was, you know, it's not something that we think about. And I guess people maybe that have had pet fish or fish companions mm-hmm. Might know that, but it's not really something I'm familiar with.
Yeah, it's really something, because I think people tend, and I asked him about this, as you'll hear, people tend to see fish, people can sometimes see them as sort of decorations, like, I want a fish tank for my house so that I have these pretty fish to look at. But, you know, these are individuals who are suddenly, they're living in a box, and I don't believe any animal wants to live in a box for their whole life, and there's just so much misunderstanding. I think the fact that they live, I mean, as Jonathan Balcom mentioned in his talk, they're literally under the surface, literally and figuratively. You know, they don't make sounds like we do. They don't blink their eyes like we do, because they're underwater. They're so different from us, and yet there is a lot more that we have in common than most people realize.
You're right. We form relationships. We do the same. They do the same thing that we do in that way. Make friendships, help each other. Like he had those little, I can't remember what they called, but the little fish that were going up to the bigger fish and eating the little bits of
the
dead skin and stuff
yeah.
like that off them. And yeah, and it was like, that's a symbiotic relationship, you know, what...
Mm-hmm. And they, yeah, and in relation to that, he was talking about how fishes have culture. You know, there's different communities of fishes, and they have different cultures, just like humans do, or any other species of animal. So it's worth acknowledging that they're more than, you know, as if you hear about fishes in the news and mainstream media outlets, then most often they're referred to in the context of like fish stocks. You know, you talk about fishing and healthy fish stocks in the ocean as if they're just a resource for us, but
exactly.
They are actually thinking, feeling individuals.
They're not a commodity. Maybe we can hear that interview now with Jonathan Balcom.
So since your book came out, there's been some stuff in the news lately. It seems to come and go, the question of, do fish feel pain? And given all the research over all these years, to me it seems kind of funny that this is still being posed as a question. And it sort of had me wondering if you've noticed any improvement over the past couple of years as far as awareness goes of fish intelligence and sentience.
Oh, the latter for sure. I mean, I was partly motivated to write this book because of the growing wealth of information reflecting on how the fishes think and feel, and the fact that they are as complex as any other group of vertebrates in terms of some of their capacities of what they can do. And I'll cover some of the highlights of that in my talk tonight. As for the fish pain debate, there are a few naysayers, and there maybe always will be. We can always resort to agnosticism and say, well, we just can't know because we can't get inside the body of the fish. It's absolutely true. Any more than I can know how you're feeling right now or what you're thinking right now. Minds are private. And so there's always that crux that somebody can use. But if we look at the weight of evidence, the evidence, in my view, for fish pain is vastly superior to the evidence, any evidence against it.
There seems to be a debate about what exactly, what boxes you have to tick in order to call a creature sentient. What do you classify as
sentience? Right. An organism who has some conscious awareness would be qualified for sentience. So that's not necessarily helpful because it leaves us back with that privacy issue of, well, who is conscious or sentient? But if an animal responds flexibly, if an animal shows phenomena like recognition systems, memory, culture, individuality, personality, things like that, and stress, pain, pleasure, there's evidence for all of those and many other phenomena in fishes. Now granted, fishes are a huge group, 33,000+ species, so what applies to one fish may not to another, so we need to be a little guarded about generalizing. But as to the question as to whether any fish is sentient or not, I can't envision any member of the vertebrate group, and fishes are all vertebrates, as not being sentient. They clearly qualify. And now we're finding science is showing that a growing number of invertebrates appear to be sentient as well, such as octopuses and squids, decapod crustaceans, crabs and lobsters. There's empirical evidence from careful scientific studies supporting sentience in those groups.
So you have far more knowledge than the average person on what the natural lives of fishes are like. For most of us living in cities, our first introduction to fish and the lives of fish might be in something like an aquarium in somebody's apartment. Given your knowledge of fish, what would you say to somebody who is interested in keeping fish in an aquarium at their home?
Sure. Well, I guess I would say think twice, because the aquarium fish industry is pretty problematic. Most fishes that end up in aquariums are caught in the wild, so they're wildlife, or they used to be wildlife. And the conditions of capture, holding, transport, and often the ending, the final environment in the home, are such that mortality is very high. It's being compared to the cut flower trade. So it's estimates of up to 90% of fish die within, by the time they get to the destination where they're sold in the pet store. And then of those who survive that, only about 10% are still living a year later. So that's a huge problem that most people aren't aware of, and I think people need to be aware of that before they get a fish for their home.
What about the well-being of fish who are in an aquarium? I've had friends say, I'll take really good care of them and they'll be happy, you know, just a couple of little betta fishes or something and they won't mind. So what is life like for a fish in a tank versus in their natural environment?
Well, captivity almost invariably involves denials of certain natural behaviors that fishes would normally engage in. Freedoms are taken away. There are some fishes who may have very small home ranges that might be able to fare fairly well in captivity, but the vast majority, I think, their basic biological needs are not being fully met. Consider, say, the royal blue tang, which has a natural habitat of between 2 and 50 meters in the wild of depth. You're just not going to provide that depth and natural water pressure in a tank. So that's something that most of us are not even thinking about. Light patterns, noises, social needs. Often fishes are the only member of their species in the tank, so they can't interact with others of their own kind. These are all some of the considerations that, and some of the needs that are not met in tanks.
Another way that people might become familiar with fish who don't have your scientific background would be in the supermarket, the fish that people eat. And so I'm curious to know, do you eat fish yourself?
The last fish I ate was probably in the early 1980s, so I stopped eating animals around that time. So yeah, I don't eat fish. I do like to eat the garden fillets.
Those are delicious.
Fish-like, but not actual fish.
And yeah.
In my talk tonight, I'll show a few slides of companies that are developing fish alternatives that are coming out imminently or soon in the next couple of years, including the clean meat approach where they're actually using actual fish cells to create fish-like meat, but it didn't involve a whole fish suffering.
Excellent. So when it comes to the fishes that people wind up keeping in tanks in their apartment or eating for dinner, then biologically speaking, these animals aren't all that different than, say, a dog or a cat or even a human with regards to their capacity to feel.
In terms of their capacity to feel, I don't believe there's any difference between eating a salmon or a pike and eating a pig or a cow or a chicken, for that matter.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, and we look forward to your talk.
Sure. Thanks.
So it was great to speak to Jonathan there at the cult last week. And if any of our listeners want tips for things to eat other than fishes, then hit us up, animalvoices.org.
That's great. I also wanted to just point out one thing that I really noticed in his talk was he put up a slide of a picture of a man with a hook through his mouth and coming out his cheek. And there was an audible gasp from the audience. And I just, you know, it made me think of how we are just, we tend to just apply that pain to humans and not to fish.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that he mentioned in his talk also was the market for aquaria fish. And lately I've been noticing more of these little beautiful fish in tiny, tiny tanks in places like Bosley's and pet food shops that don't normally sell animals, which is why I shop there, and they've brought these in, and they're called Betta splendens, or often called Siamese fighting fish.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to have surged in popularity lately, and it's so sad how they're kept and how they're marketed. The other day in Bosley's, I commented to one of the staff on the tiny little tanks with no plants, no food, no heat, no filtration system, and all stacked on top of one another. And the staff member there happily explained to me that it was no problem because naturally they lived their lives in muddy, shallow water, only a few inches deep. And I thought, huh, I didn't know a lot about them, so I had to do some research. But this is where the misinformation and misconceptions begin, is in the places that are actually commodifying these fish and selling them. So mm-hmm. I wanted to put some of the misconceptions out there. So actually they do live in shallow water, but they're ponds or they're slow-moving streams and sometimes in rice paddies. They typically come from Thailand, Laos, that area of the world. And because they live in warm countries in reasonably shallow waters, they're used to really warm water. So not room temperature water, but more like 76 to 82 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, I still think in Fahrenheit. and they get their oxygen mostly or largely from the surface of the water. They're called a labyrinth fish. So a labyrinth fish is one that has a special organ known as a labyrinth, which allows the fish to breathe air from the surface of the water. So they have gills, but they're kind of, they have these two systems going on.
Hmm.
And later I'll tell you about the mating and how that comes into play. They need about at least 10 liters of water. And it has to be heated and filtered in order for them to survive, if not thrive, but at least survive. They can't survive on plant roots. So one of the things that's happening is florists are selling these fish in vase-like containers with these plants growing up the top with their roots going into the water. Now, people think, oh, they call it a complete system, right? The fish and the plant, and it's going to be in this relationship. Not.
No.
No. The fish, the betta, are actually carnivorous. They eat insects and insect larvae. That's what they live on. They will eat plant roots and stuff if they have to, if that's all they have. But really, those fish are just dying a slow, terrible starvation death. So the mating, I'm going to tell you about the mating. True to their name, the males fight. Sometimes a female watches this display of force. And if she does, the female will be more likely to pick the male who has won the fight. How about that? And the defeated fish will most likely try to select a female who did not witness his loss. face. So not so different from another species I know of. They also build the males actually build these bubble nests right up on the surface. They blow bubbles through their mouths and they build this little nest. So then the female comes along and the male kind of wraps himself around her and gives her a big hug, and some of her eggs come out, and then he gives her another hug. She keeps doing that till all the eggs are out of her and she's spawned. And then if any of the little eggs don't land in the nest, he will actually go and pick them up with his mouth and carefully place them back in the nest.
What a guy.
I know, right? Where do I find one like that? Anyways, the bottom line is these are individuals. They have feelings. They have lives. Please do not buy Siamese fighting fish.
Mm-hmm. Or any, don't buy any animal for that matter.
Exactly.
Individuals, not commodities.
Exactly.
I have slowly and reluctantly come to the conclusion that as it stands now, honest doctors can no longer practice honest medicine. We have a complete healthcare system failure.
We are contemplating an agricultural crisis, an ecological crisis, as well as the climate breakdown crisis, and it's being driven by the food that we eat and the way that it's produced. The world has plenty of scope to feed 9 billion, 10 billion, 12 billion people, but not if we're all eating steak and chicken and pork.
I've got to say, if I'm calling time on this industry, I think time is well and truly past.
You know, the evidence is clear. The future is definitely plant-based.
2018, this next year, is our year. Like, it's the year we go mainstream.
So what we're definitely seeing for 2018, the theme overall is plant-based eating.
I do feel the best I've ever felt in my life, in my 32 years, physically.
For me, I want to bring a message, which is veganism, and that there doesn't have to be torture in fabulous fashion.
In 2018, I have seen an explosive growth in the vegan movement.
A vegan world is coming.
There's a 500% increase in vegans in the United States since 2014. That's like a growing number.
It's not just a trend. It's not just a phase.
I really do feel that this movement is going to just skyrocket.
Hey everybody, thanks for watching this video. If any of you last year saw Vegan 2017, the film, that was a smaller project and a bit of a test run ahead of this documentary, which is a feature length and something I've been wanting to do for years. I've got so much I could say about how it's looking, the team alongside me who's featured in it, but I'm just going to keep this short and sweet. If you want to support this project, please consider joining our PBN Insiders page. On the platform, you'll be able to get all of the behind-the-scenes footage, bonus interview segments not shown in the film, vegan diet guides, cooking segments, and much, much more. It costs the price of a sandwich to join, and crucially, it's very important for me to mention that if enough people sign up, we'd be able to do some really, really cool things, including premieres of the film around the world, like what we did with Dominion earlier in the year, and would also help with the production and other distribution costs, so that collectively we can spread the word. And on that note, as I'm overwhelmed with excitement about this project because big things are coming, I'll see you guys soon.
That is a trailer for a new feature-length film directed by Plant-Based News founder Claus Mitchell. It will be showing on Tuesday, November 27th at 6:30 and again at 8:30 p.m. at the UBC Robson Square location, 800 Robson Street. Tickets are $10 at the door or through Eventbrite. Sounds like a good presentation to go to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Carol Davies McIntosh with Sinead Sanders and Jody, and you're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio.
And now for our feature interview. Dr. Elizabeth Ormandy is the executive director and co-founder of the Animals in Science Policy Institute, a Vancouver-based charity which aims to promote better science without the exploitation of animals. Hello, Elizabeth, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Yes. Thanks for being with us here today. So,
you're so welcome.
Yeah. So the Animals in Science Policy Institute has been a registered charity since 2015. Can you tell us a bit about how it got started?
Sure. Well, it all got started when Dr. Sarah Dubois from the BCSPCA introduced me to Leslie Fox from the Association for the Protection of Fur-Bearing Animals. And the three of us met over pie at Aphrodite's Cafe in early 2015. And prior to that, for years, I'd been wondering why Canada didn't seem to have a national charity solely focused on animals used for scientific purposes. I come from the UK, and there are a number of charities there with this focus on animals in science. But in Canada, there were no registered charities I could find that were working deeply or broadly for animals in science. And I kind of complained to anyone that would listen about that for several years. I tried to pitch myself as, once I finished my PhD, I tried to pitch myself as the animals in research person for major animal charities. But I didn't really get anywhere. So when Sarah, Leslie, and I met up that day, we talked a fair bit about the pressing issues that animals in science face. And Leslie shared that for years she'd been working in her free time, kind of off the side of her desk, to end the use of animals in dissection. And so we agreed that this would be an issue where we might get some significant traction and make some really positive impacts for animals. We submitted a proposal to Lush Cosmetics as part of their Charity Pot program, and we kind of made an agreement that if we got the money, we'd found a nonprofit. And we got the money, so thanks to Lush Cosmetics. They've been a great supporter of ours. And then we became a registered charity in 2017. So the rest is kind of history, but that's how it all got going.
Right on. Well, I want to get into as much of the work that you're doing as we can here. But first, I want to discuss the lecture event that that you presented at the CULTS last week. As we discussed earlier on the show, the event featured Dr. Jonathan Balcombe, who spoke of the research in his book, What a Fish Knows. Carol and I were both there and learned a lot of fascinating information, but one thing audience members seemed particularly surprised by was when you mentioned that fishes are now the most commonly used animals in science. Can you tell us why that is?
I can do my best, for sure. I think there are lots of reasons fish are used in science. So if we think about lab-based fish, there's a little fish called zebrafish, and they're commonly used in lab-based science. And they're used for a whole host of different things, but they're very commonly used in developmental biology. They are transparent when they're juveniles, so you can see their insides and track their organ development without having to resort to invasive measures to do that. In addition to that, the zebrafish genome was one of the earliest mapped genomes for lab animal species. And so they've been genetically modified, gene edited, you know, they've gone through something called ENU mutagenesis. They're often used in genetic studies. And I think there's also a perception that these little zebrafish are easy to keep. But as we learned at Jonathan's talk, it's very likely that just because we can keep them alive in lab settings and they seem to be okay, it doesn't necessarily equate to them having good lives or good welfare. Another major reason fish are used in science is for environmental or aquaculture studies. And I think when most people think about the use of animals in science, often images of animals in labs are what first come to mind. But there are a great deal of animal-based studies done in other settings, like in commercial agriculture or aquaculture settings or out in the field. Fish are the primary species category used for environmental toxicology studies. And, of course, since fish are the most consumed animal on the planet, there's also a great deal of aquaculture research done with fish as well. So I think when we add all those things together, it works out that they are a really highly used animal for scientific purposes.
Wow. Well, when we talk about the ways that fishes are treated, whether in relation to science or recreation, like fishing or food, there are a lot of people who say, well, that doesn't matter because fish can't feel pain anyway. So what do these people need to know? What are these people missing? How do you respond to those who claim that fishes can't feel?
So as you know, I'm a scientist. I'm a neuroscientist by training, so kind of nerves and pain perception are kind of my jam. And I always refer back to available evidence. And for me, the evidence is plentiful enough at this point, and was plentiful enough back in 2004, that I'm confident to say that fish feel pain. There are a great many resources if people do want to learn more. So a few scientists to keep an eye out for on social media are Drs. Lynn Sneddon, Victoria Braithwaite, and Colin Brown. And these folks have done extensive work to provide scientific evidence on fish cognition and their ability to feel pain. And there are also fish-specific advocacy groups like Fish Feel, and there's a group called Let Fish Live, and they both have very active social media accounts as well that people can follow if they're interested in learning more about fish specifically. So I would tend to refer people to those experts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were some things that Jonathan described in his talk that just seemed so clear when he described the experiment of injecting the fishes with certain substances and what was motivating them to move from one area of the mm-hmm. tank to another. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah, yeah. Can you describe that a little bit for people, just as an example of something?
Oh, goodness. I believe it was when fish were given a painful stimulus and they could, of their own choice, swim and spend time in a tank that was actually very brightly lit. So it isn't an area that they would prefer to stay in. They had the option between staying in a dark tank with foliage, which is where fish would prefer to hang out. They were given a painful stimulus, but there was an analgesic, a painkiller, put in the bright barren tank, and they could swim across to that tank to get pain relief. And so these experiments for animal welfare science are actually quite common, and it's like an approach avoidance learning. You're asking an animal to trade off something that it really values, like this safe, dark space where they do feel a bit more protected, and you're asking them to trade off that for pain relief. And because the fish would spend more time in the brightly lit tank that was giving them pain relief, the conclusion is that they value pain relief, therefore they must have been feeling it in the first place to want relief from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were lots of examples that he mentioned like that that just made it seem so clear to me. So in the last month or so even, particularly in the last year, this topic has come up in some major media outlets all over the world, including a piece in The Guardian entitled, "Are We Wrong to Assume Fish Can't Feel Pain?" And a CBC piece with the headline, "Do Fish Feel Pain? Scientists Are Divided on the Answer." Given all this information, why the resistance to the facts? As a scientist yourself, why do you think people are still debating the facts that fishes can feel?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I don't agree with the CBC headline. I don't think it's true that scientists are divided on the answer. I think the majority of scientists who have actually made the effort to study pain in fish have concluded that they do have that capacity. So sure, there might be a few individuals who are holding out on that conclusion, but I don't think it's correct to say that scientists are divided. I think the issue is still being debated because there's evolutionary conservation between mammals, including humans, of things like facial expression. So when another mammal is in pain or experiencing joy, we can empathize with their experiences quite readily. Fish don't tend to trigger our empathy. They give no vocalizations that we can readily hear. They don't have facial expressions that we can understand. If you add to that the fact that they live in habitats that are so vastly different from ours, and habitats that we seldom visit, and even when we do, we can only stay there for brief periods of time with the aid of breathing apparatus, I think it all adds up to our struggle to relate to fish in a meaningful way. And then if people can't relate, it's easier to dismiss fish's experiences, and unfortunately that can result in them being treated inhumanely.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that Guardian article I mentioned, which I'd recommend. I'd recommend that one more highly than that CBC piece for sure. Yeah, the article is called "Are We Wrong to Assume Fish Can't Feel Pain?" And and one of the things that that was brought up in that piece was that if we think about it, if we're honest with ourselves, to acknowledge that fish feel pain is too painful for us to contemplate, given the way that we treat them. So it seems to be, you know, another case, as is the case with a lot of animal rights issues and social justice issues in general, you know, acknowledging that there is something here and that these individuals have rights and have the ability to feel things, and then reconciling that with how we have been treating them for so very long.
I think it's a painful realization. I also can be quite daunting if you think about how much we would have to change our actions. We'd have to change our entire systems. And so I think people are just like, oh my gosh, that's just too hard. I don't think that's right, but I think that's part of exactly what you were saying. Like, it's part of the, I'm just going to plug my ears and, like, not pay attention to this, because it's easier. It would be a major inconvenience to have to think about the daunting task of overhauling our aquaculture system.
Absolutely. Carol, you had a comment?
Yeah, I was reading your website, Elizabeth, and wow, lots and lots of information on there, and lots of great educational aids and whatnot for teachers and students as well. One of the things that I came across somehow, I'm not sure if it was actually on your site or whether it was a linked article, but BAM, the belief in animal mind. So the way that people's attitudes are towards the use of animals in science and for experimentation and dissection, etc., has to do with what they believe the animals feel or think or have, if they have if they're capable of problem solving, if they're self-aware. Do you see, like, I can see that with what you were just saying about fish, is that we don't relate very well to fish, but I think that we also have, that's kind of that BAM thing is with other animals as well, and any kind of animal in science. Does it resonate with you?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that the belief in animal mind raises a really interesting ethical dilemma for people who engage in animal research, because on the one hand, if we start understanding that animals are like us, then maybe it's true that they can be appropriate stand-ins and we get relevant scientific data from them. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, if we agree that animals are like us, then in terms of belief in animal mind, that is, then we cannot escape the fact that we owe them moral duties. And so I think there's this really interesting dilemma that presents itself when people argue that animals make good models for humans, which is a whole, like, other conversation, because I don't believe that they do. But they, you know, for people who will, like, defend animal research because animals make good models, it's like, well, if you're modeling humans and we don't ethically accept this type of research on humans, but the animals are like us, then that's a really sticky situation right there.
Mm-hmm. And how do scientists reconcile that?
They don't.
Yeah, okay.
yeah, just sort of.
But you're there to help them.
Sure.
Yeah.
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 Because I've had some interesting tense moments in my life to date.
I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, other animals are like us enough to use them, but not like us enough to afford them the same respect. It doesn't quite add up. Education is such a big part of this, you know, as we're talking about, there's some common forms of teaching and learning that actually harm animals. So can you tell us more about how animals are used in education and why it's a problem?
Absolutely. This is one of our major programs of work at ASPE. So the obvious harm to animals here is the continued use of dissection. That is the kind of cutting open of dead animals to teach anatomy and adaptation to function. often happens in secondary science education as well as university level. We mainly focus on elementary and secondary school education just because of the different stakeholders that are at play. We obviously have things to say about the university level, but we just haven't got there yet in terms of our actual program of work. So the animals used for dissection, regardless of whether they're going to be used in secondary schools or tertiary level, university level education, they're often inhumanely raised and or killed for the solely for the purpose of being used as a specimen. So there's quite an obvious harm there in terms of the animals not having having a life well lived and not having a humane death. And I think there's also the very dangerous perception that animals are tools and commodities with instrumental value rather than sentient living beings with inherent value. So those are the harms to animals, but there's also detriments to teachers and students and science teaching culture as well. So, for example, for students, a switch to non-animal teaching methods would be far better for their education. And we have a literature review of 50 academic studies to back up that point. So with using non-animal methods, students can consolidate their learning by repeating exercises, and there are far fewer ethical or emotional barriers to their learning.
Mm-hmm.
Non-animal methods provide safer and more inclusive educational experiences for students. For teachers, non-animal alternatives are often cheaper in both the short and the long term, which, given our struggling BC education budgets, it should be music to the ears of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mess, no fuss, no harsh chemicals or dead animal bodies to dispose of once you're done. So it's kind of, they're a lot easier for teachers to implement in their classrooms if you're using things like virtual dissections or models. And more fundamentally, for us at ASPE, the continued practice of dissection promotes this culture of science that doesn't respect animal life. It teaches young scientists that it's perfectly okay to kill animals and to take them apart in the name of science. So at ASPE, we're challenging that existing culture and hoping to stand by our mandate of building a more ethical culture of science that respects animal life. And we really believe that that starts with focusing on early science education.
I know that I was just talking to my daughter about it the other day, and when she was in elementary school, I think it was grade 6, they had to dissect. They were asked to dissect something or watch something being dissected. I don't even know what kind of an animal it was, but mm-hmm. she was actually reminiscing about that and saying how traumatizing that was for her, because she was raised as a vegetarian, so for her, you know, it was a big ethical issue, and she felt like she was forced into that. So I can see where there would be a lot of psychological issues with kids in that are forced to do that sort of thing. Are you noticing that?
Yeah, that's a remarkably common story that I hear from both parents and from people who reminisce about their science education.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very common thing that I hear.
Right.
Sure.
So tell us more about the alternatives to animals in mm-hmm. education. How has ASPE been working with schools to replace animals?
So there are hundreds and hundreds of non-animal alternatives to dissection that are out there. I think that it can get overwhelming for teachers to kind of do their own research on it. So what we do is we help connect teachers to information that's relevant to them so that they can easily make the switch to using non-animal alternatives. There's some key ways that we do that. So first is our guest class program. So teachers can book us for a guest class or an information session for their science teaching team, and we'll work with them to create a class for their students using non-animal alternatives. Or in the information sessions, we just go and demo some things for their science teaching team and show them how to use them so that they can just teach the classes themselves. We have an online alternative database, so it's heavily curated by us. Because there's so much out there, we really listen to teachers and what they want and what is most easy to implement in their classrooms. And so we curated an alternative database based on what we heard from teachers, so that they don't have to trawl through the hundreds of options that they have. They can actually go to our database, type in frog, and then it will filter out and they'll get a few really key options for learning about frogs. for example. We do offer free class plans. We're in the final stages of making those public, and those are going to be translated into French as well, because you know, French immersion teachers need resources too. We do pre-service science teacher education, so that is people who are in their science teacher training programs at university. What we realized was that one of the barriers was that by the time teachers are in service as teachers, they teach the way they were taught to teach, and there's very little time for them mm-hmm. to research other options. So we thought, well, if we can get them while they're in their training program, then that's a way of really reaching a lot more teachers in, who are going on to be in like, based in schools.
Wow.
And then we have our Teaching and Student Awards, which you were both there on Friday last week, and mm-hmm. That was a new thing for us this year. We really want to publicly recognize people who are doing really great things to replace animals in their classrooms. So I think getting that public recognition, and especially giving prize money to teachers, that's something that I think will make a difference.
That was remarkable to see the awards given to those students who brought forth the student mm-hmm. choice program within North Vancouver, is it?
Yeah, North Vancouver School District. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And can you tell us more about how much progress has been made in schools because of your efforts and the efforts of students speaking up about this?
Yeah, I mean, say, because it's very grassroots, we take every win. It's really hard to track. You know, if I have a conversation with a teacher, it's hard for me to know whether they go away and then replace animals in their classrooms. But we do estimate that thanks to our work, close to 3,000 animals have been replaced in classrooms. That's based on the guest classes that we've done, the teacher outreach that we've done, the teacher engagement when we go to teacher conferences, and things like that. And that might sound like a really small number in the grand scheme of things, but I think what's going to happen is that as we just keep working on this issue and keep it in the public consciousness, then it will snowball.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. So earlier this month, ASPE announced some great news. Starting next year, UBC will be offering a new undergraduate course on non-animal methods in biomedical sciences. It'll be the first course of its kind to be offered at a Canadian public research university, and you, Dr. Elizabeth mm-hmm. Ormandy, will be teaching it. So can you tell us more about the course and the significance of this victory?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The course is going to focus on emerging technologies that are replacing animals in biomedical sciences, and that's a field that is moving incredibly quickly. I've been teaching at UBC since 2011, and I often hear from my students that if only there were alternatives to using animals in research, testing, and education. And the thing is that there are already a great many alternatives, and there are more being developed all the time. So I really saw a gap in the education of UBC science students, and so I put in a course proposal to the Integrated Science Department at UBC, and we got funding from the BC Foundation for Non-Animal Research. I'm very grateful that the department said yes to the proposal. The course will cover non-animal methods in testing, research, and education. So we'll cover things like organ-on-a-chip technology, lab-grown mini-brains, 3D bioprinting, computer modeling, high-throughput in vitro methods, things like that. We'll also cover the political landscape related to the use of animals in science. So, mm-hmm. for example, the Netherlands has made a governmental commitment to phase out the use of animals in all types of testing, so drugs, vaccines, chemicals, pesticides, by 2025. So this course will help prepare biomedical students for this evolving world, because very soon they'll be expected to be well-versed in these technologies. And we plan to do a field trip to a local biosystems company that was founded by UBC graduates, so students will get that first-hand experience of non-animal methods. To my knowledge, there's no other course like this currently being offered at another Canadian university. Similar courses have run in the U.S., and I know that there are some proposals in the works. But I think that to get a major research university like UBC mm-hmm. to offer a course like this is really great. So it'll start in January 2020. It'll be course code ISCI 330. And I'm going to guess that I'm going to have a lot of fun next year doing the course development for it.
Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
That's a major move.
Yeah, absolutely. That was great news to hear about. And for anybody who's interested in learning about it, you can check that out at UBC. But for all our listeners who just want to help end the suffering and exploitation of animals in education and testing and research, what can we do? What can everyday people do to help animals who are suffering in these contexts?
Yeah, I think that in terms of animal-based science, it can be really frustrating for animal advocates because it's an issue that's very much behind closed doors, and often there's a privilege granted to certain select individuals in terms of knowing about what actually goes on. No one can really vote with their dollars, so it's a really good question about what people can do. The first thing I would say is, while animal-based science is pretty much a closed shop, there is also a great deal of information out there to get you started. I'm always open to phone calls if people want to know stuff. I'll be honest about when I don't know things, because there are things sometimes, even when you work relatively on the inside, things are kept confidential. But get to know the system, get to know its flaws, get to know the little amount of data that is provided, and use it. Second, I would demand greater transparency. So as tax-paying citizens, you have the right to know what your tax dollars are being spent on. So we should all be asking questions of the governing bodies that grant money for the use of animals in research. I would also take care with language and be specific. So I often see people using the words animal experimentation or animal testing to cover everything. But I personally think it's important to separate out animal testing, animal research, and use of animals in education. Mm-hmm. These are three broad categories of the use of animals in science, and I separate them because they have different oversight systems, different stakeholders, different ethical issues. So I think getting clear on what each of these mean and then identifying the stakeholders that make sense to talk to is really important. I would also say that for those who are working within the system to push for change, there's a lot of... I sometimes feel like, with the best will in the world, there are some individuals in the animal rights community who can get a bit judgy. But I would encourage people, don't judge people for, selling out just because they're using different strategies. And in particular for animals in science, animal advocates or animal rights activists, they're very often excluded from the meaningful dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I know this firsthand because I worked for our Canadian Oversight Agency, and I can tell you that even the most basic non-inflammatory questions about animal-based science tend to be framed as threats when they come from animal rights activists. If you know you've been excluded, think about messaging. And I'm definitely not into tone policing, so that's not my intention here. But I feel like, if for those of us who do currently have, in quotes, an inside seat, we also need your support. So there are some great organizations who are working directly with the animal-based science community to get replacement of animals implemented. So I would say support those organizations.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Elizabeth, and for all the great work that you're doing. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And for more information, you can visit their website at animalsinscience.org. It's a great website. You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, November 30th, with Elise Jacobson and Sinead Sanders again. Today's show was brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth and chronic illness, regreen our planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now's the time for a plant-based economy, because on our big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. We want to connect with you so you can stream shows, download our podcasts, read our show blog, and subscribe via iTunes at animalvoices.org. Stay in touch with us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver or Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And also, please send us your suggestions and comments. What kind of show would you like to see? What is there something new you're interested in? Is there something new that's come up that you'd like to get fleshed out in this show? So either through Animal Voices Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We'll be closing today's show with a song by our very own Sinead Sanders called Wishes to the Fishes. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock when Alex Smith will be talking about the fires in California. Thanks so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember, be kind to the animals.
If I could breathe underwater, I'd tell the other fishes that my bad fancy sister to be one with you. And then out in the water, I feel I'm in a dish because I just can't seem to get through to you. Living like me is something you never really want. You gotta live out your life how you wanna do. Living in the sea is something I could really break down. Something that blew around in the corner and blew. Whoa, 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 whoa. But in case you haven't noticed, it keeps on calling, it keeps on calling around. In case you are ghost, you know it keeps on calling, it keeps on calling around. Yeah. If you should cut the lick, you know I couldn't take it, cause I don't know if I could go in after you. And it was all I did, even made my way down, even make my way, even made my way down, even make my way, even made my way down. But in case you haven't noticed, it keeps on going, it keeps on going around. In case you are a ghost, you know it keeps on going, it keeps on going around. Oh. Oh. If I could breathe on the water, I'd tell the other fishes that my bad first sister took to be one with you. And it ain't all I intend to even make my way down, even make my way, to even make my way down, even make my way through the, make my way down, even make my way, to even make my way down. Make my way down. But in case you haven't noticed, it keeps on calling, it keeps on calling around. In case you are a ghost, you know it keeps on calling, it keeps on calling around. In case you haven't noticed, it keeps on calling.